Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Reflections on Ethics.
Today, we begin the discussion of ethics associated with taking and sending. Now, there are a couple of points that are probably worth noting about ethics in general and Buddhist ethics in particular, and maybe a few other things too. I think in the larger picture, the question of ethics, or the whole subject of ethics, arose because it was how a society sought to govern the behavior of people so that the society could actually survive and wasn't torn apart. We aren't the least bit concerned with those ethics, or that sort of ethics. Buddhist practice ultimately is asocial, and it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to argue that it was also amoral. Because the role of what we are calling ethics here is not about acting in such a way that we hold society together or we don't contribute to its disintegration. That is of actually no concern. It is how do we comport ourselves in our lives to support the practice of waking up or being awake. So there's a very, very different approach, a very different understanding. And an example of which many of you probably have read in my book . Come into a situation, you know what the right thing to do is, it's going to cost you something, maybe it'll cost you some money, maybe it'll cost you your job, maybe it'll cost you a friendship. But you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards? The answer is not at all. What if you don't do it? And then you think about it a lot. And this is the essence, in my mind, of the Buddhist approach to ethics. It's how do we comport ourselves in our lives so that our mind is clear, open, and awake, and is not disturbed or distracted by reactive processes and emotions and things like that. So that's one piece. Second piece is that, in Buddhism, even though they're not always worded this way, or even taught this way, the moral injunctions are primarily descriptive, not prescriptive. By that, I mean, when you read these lists of do this and do that and do this and don't do that, they're describing how a person who is awake actually behaves. And this fits with what I was saying earlier about the difference between modern and traditional societies. In that, in a traditional perspective, the way that you realize your potential, your spiritual potential in our case, as a human being, is by emulating examples or past examples of perfection. So these descriptions become very important because then we emulate that behavior and moves us in the right direction. The emphasis on individualism in American society in particular, and some other societies in the world, and the peculiar quirks of the American archetypes, namely the Puritan and the cowboy, put most of us in a relationship with ethics that is one of conflict. You know, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And then at the same time, we're vying to be completely pure in our practice. But nobody's going to tell me what to do. So you have the Puritan and the cowboy. Yes?
I'm confused about the difference between prescriptive and descriptive. Can you give us an example?
Well, prescriptive means you do this, you do this, you do this. And the Ten Commandments are prescriptive, okay? Descriptive is, this is how a person who is awake is likely to behave. This is what it looks like. They don't kill. They don't tell lies. That. And then it's up to you what you do. But now you have the example.
So the long list of vows that monks and nuns have to take are considered descriptive rather than prescriptive?
The intention, and that is absolutely true of those vows, is that this describes how an awake person behaves. And so that you don't see an awake person frivolously dancing and singing. So that's why there's precepts is not to dance or sing. Now, I need to correct something here. As you say, there is a long list of precepts, and for a fully ordained monk, it's something like 253 or 256, depending on the tradition. But in the actual ordination ceremony, you only make 5 commitments. The rest are guidelines. And the ones that are regarded as very serious offenses, and the ones that were regarded as moderately serious offenses, the ones regarded as so-so offenses, and then ones regarded as just minor offenses, and then very minor offenses. And it's all laid out like that. But the actual vows, vow is really not the right word. That's in the Vajrayana level. It's totally different. Well, I suppose vows, okay. It's ordination that's the wrong word. You say in the presence of, in the case of monk's vows, of an abbot, I will not take the life of a human being. I will not steal anything of value, which is defined as a week's supply of rice. I will not lie about my spiritual attainments. I will not have sex, in the case of a monk or a nun. And I will not take anything that has been fermented. That's the vow against intoxicants. Those are the actual vows, the promises, and you just say, these are the actions that I'm going to refrain from. That's what the ordination ceremony consists of. Everything else are guidelines for behavior, which is about holding the community of the monks together in a way that was supported awakening. Okay?
So those five are prescriptive.
And the rest are?
Well, those five are promises you are making to yourself. You know, you aren't making them to the abbot. You're making them to yourself. You're saying it in the presence of the abbot, but you're saying, this is how I'm going to live my life. You feel the difference? That's very important. Okay. So, one of the idiosyncrasies of Tibetan Buddhism is the muddling, I think is not too strong a term, of Vajrayana and Mahayana, or Sutrayana, elements. So, for instance, and it goes back to some extent to Indian Buddhism, though not as much. And whenever things cross boundaries, you got a bunch of scholars who just raged on and on about what was really going on here. So, for instance, in the Heart Sutra, you have Shariputra asking Avalokiteshvara, how does a son or daughter train in the perfection of a noble family, train in the perfection of wisdom? And you wouldn't believe the amount of commentary in Indian and Tibetan commentaries, but this is a Mahayana Sutra. What's Shariputra doing there? You know, he's Hinayana. He shouldn't be there. And so there are long, long explanations of this. And then there's an equally long explanation of what is this mantra doing in this Mahayana text? It shouldn't be there. You know, Amgati Gati Paragati Parasamgati Bodhisvaha. And so here we have this term commitments of mind training, and it is the Tibetan word damsik, which is a translation of the Sanskrit word samaya, which is usually used only in a Vajrayana context. So the question is, why did Chekala, who is obviously aware of these distinctions, being an extraordinarily brilliant scholar, academic, among other things, why did he choose the word, this very, very strong word? It's a very strong word in Vajrayana, that when you violate what the word damsik, what the word samaya means, it literally means holy word in Tibetan. So it's a very deep level. You could say it's a spiritual promise. You know, it doesn't get much stronger than that. And if you violate that, it can rupture your relationship with your teacher. So it's very heavy-duty stuff. So why is he using such a heavy-duty word here? You'd never find this in other, like in the discussion of the Bodhisattva vow, you never find any discussion of spiritual promise in that sense. Samaya, what you do find is precepts to be observed and guidelines for training. You find that. But you don't find this spiritual promise. So my theory is that he's using this very, very heavy, very powerful word to say, these are really important points that I'm going to give you right now. It's underlining it. It's like, so just imagine this whole section in red highlighter. In here, in the book, I'm on page 30 and 22 in the pamphlet. And part of the reason, I think, is that we tend to get very adamant, very strong about things that we really value. They're really, really important to us. You ever notice that? We get very adamant about things that touch us deeply. And this practice was obviously something that was very, very important to Chekhov. So, and he has some fairly strong things to say. And again, remember that this was designed, there are a total of 59 instructions in here, grouped into 7 points. And the point of them was to make them easy to memorize. So you get this, and so that every time you remembered one instruction, it opened up a whole body of teaching and instruction to you. And we saw that in the summaries. There was a case of a Russian chemist who defected to Canada in it was either the late 50s or the early 60s. He's one of their top research chemists. And he decided to defect. He knew that he would not be able to take many papers with him. So he started taking all his research papers, which had been restricted to certain journals in Russia, and he would write a précis of them. And then he would write a précis of the précis. And he continued this until he got down to like one of these very small little booklets that he could put in his wallet or something like that, where each word of would basically be the précis for a whole paper. And that's how he brought all his research out of Russia, because he knew he wouldn't be able to bring the actual papers. Well, this is similar. And I know that memorization is out of fashion these days. In the spiritual context, it's really, really useful. Now, I doubt that I could repeat all of the mind training teachings by heart, but I've got an awful lot of them in memory, so, and they're just available to me. And it's wonderful. It's extremely handy when I'm teaching. But it's also very, very handy in daily life, because you see a situation and bang, up pops an instruction. So it's, you may not feel like it, but it is very, very definitely worth your while memorizing the root text, which is in the pamphlet, it's just the stuff that's in ordinary type. The stuff that's in italics in the pamphlet is on my very abbreviated comments. You can memorize those too if you find it helpful, but I'm really just talking about memorizing the root text.
Is that why Trungpa calls them slogans?
Yeah. I just, when he first came up with that, I just thought it was a complete travesty, and I think it's, Trungpa had a fascination with language, and could be brilliant, but every now and then he just missed. And that was a miss, because slogan is something that has always been associated with political or commercial use. I think it's those associations make the term unacceptable to me, because it necessarily brings in that kind of thinking when you use it. And that's why I don't use the term, and I don't find it helpful at all. See, one of the things that we face, and it's one of the reasons why I pay very, very close attention to language. Whenever you use a term from another discipline or another culture or another subject area, you necessarily import all the thinking, the ways of thinking, that gave rise to that term. And they start affecting the way that you're thinking. And I just don't feel that thinking in political and commercial terms is helpful within the spiritual context. In fact, I think it is antithetical. Another of my pet peeves on this one is the term social capital, which is completely unrelated to this discussion, but it necessarily brings in all of the ideas of capitalism when you're actually talking about human interaction. And I think it's an extremely detrimental way of thinking. There are many, many other examples I could give. So that's just my little spiel on language. Okay?
Well, it's the same repute. The disservice to using repudiation rather than what you've chosen.
Yeah.
Which softens it.
Yes. Yeah. And I used repudiation because that was, at that point, that was the best English I could come up with. It's why I'm constantly revising my translations, because as my understanding deepens and my experience deepens, then I think, oh, no, that's not what it means at all. This is what it means. So I feel like I'm approximating and getting it closer and closer. Okay. It drives people nuts because they memorize. Well, poor Gail, every time I change the translation of the Heart Sutra, she has to memorize it again, because she loves the Heart Sutra and she's memorized it, my translations, but she's gone through about 3 or 4 translations now. She says, again, please don't change it.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.